Good evening. Today is going to be a class. I think it's going to be a really good class for teens and adults alike. At least this one that I have in mind for this week and next. We're going to be looking at the topic of Christian evidences, but we're not going to do anything too intense. We'll just talk about a few things here or there that I've come across over the years, just looking at this particular topic. On Sunday mornings we're looking at the book of Genesis, and I keep having to remind myself that this is not a class on evidences. Otherwise, we'd never get out of Genesis, especially not out of the first 11 chapters. So that's what we'll be looking at tonight, as sort of a good complement to our Sunday class. In a few weeks, Sam, after he finishes his class on Colossians, he's kind of expressed a desire to take a break for a little while. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to bring up some Christian evidences, again, as a way to supplement what we're talking about on Sundays. Well, on the screen we have two scriptures, and the second one is sort of the reason why we want to go over this topic, one of the reasons why we do. And now, what does that scripture say? Well, it's 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, and it says, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you for a reason, asks you a reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear."
All right, we need to be able to give an answer for the hope that is in us, and we have a tendency to do so in a way that is ugly or not very pleasant. So what we need to be able to do is recognize the last part of that verse with meekness and fear. I think one version says with gentleness. We need to do so gently. And not try to attack people with our faith, with the things that we believe. So anything that we go over here today is not designed to attack people, but to build up your own faith. But at the same time, if you happen to be in a situation where someone where you can share this kind of stuff with someone, then you'll have some tools in your arsenal, or at least you'll be able to look back on it, because it might be a while, you might forget. So you have a chance to look back at this, and maybe it'll be helpful for you. All right, so what about that first verse up there, Romans 1:20? What does that say?
For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse.
All right, so this idea here is that his invisible attributes are clearly seen. We can clearly see the things that prove God. And while they may be clear to some, they are not clear to others. And it's always good to examine these things so that we can have some idea of what we're talking about, what we're looking at, and hopefully be able to convince others of the truth. All right, so one of the first things that you always want to do with an evidences class is find evidences for God. And I originally had a question mark on there, and then I realized you probably don't want a question mark because I answer it, or at least I have what I want to go over in a little bit. But what are some evidences that we have for God? Just some things that you can think of off the top of your head.
Honeybees.
Oh, well, okay. Not where I was going, but okay. Share with us what you mean by that, honeybees.
They are an incredibly complex creature, way beyond what we even understand now, but what we do understand, they are incredibly complex, and they interact with so much of the rest of God's creation that there is just no way on earth that they could possibly be an accident.
The human mind.
Well, let's dwell on the honeybees argument for a second. Because the human mind is a good one, but the honeybees, that's really interesting. And you're right. There is so much interdependency and codependency between bees and the flowers and things of that nature, and all the things that go along with it. It just seems I mean, how could two things like that come up evolutionarily without each other? They can't. They have to come up one depending on the other. So it just doesn't make sense. Is that the kind of thing you had in mind?
Yeah, and I think Sam has pointed it out in class before too, and maybe you as well, that the odds of this happening in an evolutionary sense are just so incredibly against it.
Right.
That there has to be an intelligent design.
Right. It boils down to, for the live stream, the odds are astronomical and that's putting it mildly, they're cosmological. They are absurdly out of this world in order for anything like that to happen through completely natural means. And so that's exactly right. And we have gone over those numbers as well. A while back, anyway. So that's a good one. And ultimately, that boils down to an argument from design, right? An argument from design, an argument from nature. I definitely have that up there, so we'll look at that. Katie had one about the mind. Tell me about that. Why is that an argument for God for you?
It's incredibly complicated in many ways. God gives us something to depend on, which basically helps us with our natural codependency on other people and things, as well as the thing about the laminins that are made that hold us all together, that are actually the shape of a cross because they're the cell adhesion molecules.
You thought this through, haven't you? All right. That's good. That's good. So there's quite a lot of complexities with the human mind that are difficult to fathom without any kind of creator. In fact, we do have, and we will go over this in the Genesis class, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? And so I want to save that for that class. But being in the image of God, and one of those things that separates us from animals is the mind. Now, yes, they have a mind, and they have something along those lines, but it's hardly to the level that we've got. There's quite a lot of difference between a human and animals. And so while there are some similarities, there are some differences. You know what? Oh, yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I'm not disagreeing with you, but the human mind, of course, has its complexity and its ability to think and all that, but a lot of the animal minds, probably all of the animal minds, are tied into instinct and ability to do all sorts of different things. That, like, our sense of smell is nowhere near what a dog's is like, or anything like that.
Yeah.
As well as animals are also born with set behaviors they know how to do. For example, you have a puppy, you put it in water, it sends some water for it, already knows how to swim. It has that ability set into its mind with majority of breeds, but humans, the babies, you can't throw them in the water without ever showing them first, they'll probably drown.
We humans do have some built-in instincts, but for the most part, they are very few compared to what animals have, or most animals anyway. But you're right, animals often have that instinct and are driven by instinct, the instinct to eat, to find food, and in some cases the instinct for social interaction, depending on the animals, or the instinct to care for their young, again depending on the animal. So they have these built-in instincts, things of that nature. How do they learn all that? Was it through evolutionary history and their collective memory, or was it given to them directly by God? I'm sure you know the answer to that. All right. So a lot of really good thoughts here. Some of the traditional arguments, one of those is the cosmological argument, or collectively known as cosmological arguments. And Paul appeals to one of those, at least, in Acts chapter 17. And so, of course, in Acts chapter 17, he's speaking to to the Athenian philosophers, the philosophers in Athens at the Areopagus. And of course, these people don't believe in the God of the Bible, the God of heaven. They believe in multiplicity of gods. And so what does he use here to try to show them that this God exists? What does that say, verses 28 and 29?
For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device.
All right, so he is basing his argument on these cosmological arguments. Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, came up with some of these, the idea of the unmoved mover, the idea of the uncaused causer, and the idea that only contingent beings cannot exist, therefore there must be a necessary being. The idea that there must be something perfect by which everything is measured. Now, what does that mean, though, an unmoved mover? Can things be moved in this galaxy, in this universe, in this world? Can anything be moved? Who did the first movement? What did the first movement?
Where did the energy come from?
What is that which causes things? I mean, you're in a room, say, and you're in a stable room, no earthquakes, so don't, you know. and there is a series of dominoes there on the table. Well, those dominoes are going to sit there forever, unless something happens to move them, right? Unless you go in there and you move it. Now you are moved, obviously, because you were created. But as far as that system is concerned, the system of the dominoes, there is no mover that is present there. Nothing will move in there, especially unless there's wind or something. But you know what I mean. There's nothing that would cause it to move. It would just stay there forever, right? Unless somebody passed it over. So an unmoved mover. And that's similar to the uncaused causer. We have the idea, of course, of cause and effect. Right, and everything is a series of cause and effect. Even my being here is cause and effect. A whole bunch of things led up in my life for me to be here with you right now to present this lesson to you. And even before that, a whole bunch of things led my parents to come together to form me and to raise me. Right, a whole lot of things came together for that. And then you keep going back. You keep going back. You keep going back until. Until what? Well, you have to have an uncaused cause. You have to have something that was not caused, something to start the causation, the causing, if you will. Does that make sense? All right. Now, what does it mean? Only contingent beings cannot exist. Therefore, there must be a necessary being. A contingent being is someone that depends on something else, right? And this is kind of along the same lines, right? I'm contingent because I was dependent upon my parents to have created me, and so on and so forth. So there must be someone at the beginning. So all these things mount up to what's called the cosmological argument. There are a few weaknesses to these arguments. I'm not saying we should use these as the whole of our arguments for the existence of God, but these are some that we can at least start with. What weaknesses can we think of?
It's a theory brought out by man.
Okay.
Uninspired.
Does it establish the existence of Yahweh, of the God of the Bible? Or just any cosmological? It doesn't establish any particular God, right? It's just something cosmological out there. It also doesn't prove the existence of a sentient thing that would have caused things to start, right? It also assumes that what's called infinite regress is impossible. That's the idea of things going back to the very beginning. There has to be something at the beginning. It assumes that there has to be something at the beginning. What's called infinite regress, where it continues to keep on. It assumes that's impossible, that there must be a starting point for everything. But we know from science that there must be a starting point for everything, don't we? Do we know why there must be a starting point? I've got two things on here. Pardon?
Well, potential energy has to be reacted onto by kinetic energy in order to create motion.
Okay. All right. Well, it does have to do with energy. You're familiar with the second law of thermodynamics? No? Oh, okay.
You teach me that, maybe.
Oh, my. Okay. I heard it's a common argument among people who talk about apologetics and things like this, so I'm a little surprised. But I'm glad we're bringing it up. So there are three laws of thermodynamics, at least the ones that I learned in school. The first one is matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It only changes forms. Okay, pretty simple enough. In fact, that kind of proves that there must be some kind of origin it proves either that that everything has always existed, or it proves that there must be some supernatural cause to everything. Something must have broken those rules in order to create things. So, of course, we believe the second one, right? Not everything wasn't always here. The second rule proves that everything wasn't always here. Because if everything was always here, there's something called the second law of thermodynamics is also called the law of entropy. The idea where disorder is the way of things. Nothing goes from disorder to order unless you have something else acting upon it, creating its own disorder in the wake. For instance, you have a messy room, right? You have a messy room all over the place, and you got clothes and toys and assuming you play with toys, I'm thinking from my kid's perspective. You have a messy room. Books, toys, clothes all over the place. It's a messy, messy room. It really needs to be picked up. Well, it's not going to get picked up on its own, right? You've got to go in there and pick things up and put things together in order. But you're expending more energy yourself to get things into order than you did to likely make things go everywhere. So that's the idea where you have that consistent, eventually it'll lead to a heat death, where everything cools down. And so that proves that there must have been some origin to everything. Something must have begun. It couldn't have always been, otherwise we'd be in heat that long time ago. Make sense? I see blinks. No nods. I hope that makes sense. All right. It also assumes that God is exempt from these rules. Of course, we believe that God is exempt from the rules of his creation. Doesn't it make sense the creator is not bound by his creation? I mean, you build a house. Are you bound to stay in that house? No. You can do other things, right? You can go outside of that house, go on top of that house, go under the house. You know, you're not bound by the house, right? So lots of things like that. So those are some weaknesses, but a lot of them are easy to remedy. A lot of them are easy to remedy by the, what's called the teleological argument. That's a fancy name, isn't it? the teleological argument. Again, simply put, this is the argument from design. Design demands a designer, right? I have a couple verses up there. We already read Romans 1:20. I kind of alluded to Hebrews 3:4 already. What does, what's that first one? Psalm 19, verse 1.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament sheweth his handiwork.
All right. So, the heavens declare the glory of God. In other words, nature proves that God is, that God exists, right? And of course, the idea of the mind, the idea of bees are a part of that. Of course, specifically, it talks about the stars in that verse, but we notice that it can refer to anything that is in the created order. What about Acts 14, verse 17? In context here, Paul is talking to a bunch of pagans, a bunch of idolaters who were about to sacrifice animals to them, thinking that they were their gods, thinking that he, Paul, and Barnabas were their gods. But he comes out and he says this speech here in Acts 14. What does he say in verse 17?
Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness.
Okay. So, filling our hearts with fruit and gladness, he gives us rain. He did, and here's a key phrase: he did not leave himself without witness, right? And the witness is his creation. Of course, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. We see in Romans 1:20, and I have up there Hebrews 3:4, which is every house has a builder, and he who builds everything is God, I think is basically the quote there. So, again, the teleological argument. If you happened upon a watch or a smartphone in the middle of the woods, you're not going to think it just happened to be there, right? You're going to assume that somebody left it there, that somebody had created it, put it together, right? It's not something that just magically comes together. It doesn't spring up out of the woods for no reason, right? It has obvious, it's obviously designed and therefore has a designer. And that's what we see with creation as well. There are a lot of arguments that people have against this, though. What about the purpose of things that appear to have no purpose, or perhaps even a destructive purpose?
Mosquitoes.
Yeah. Okay, mosquitoes. How about the appendix doesn't seem to have much of a function until it bursts, and then it's destructive, right?
That's just because man doesn't necessarily know yet what all these things do.
So when people first came up with the idea of the appendix as being unnecessary, or what they call vestigial, they just didn't know what it did. What hubris, right? They didn't realize that it actually had functionality, that it had some purpose. But there are other things, too, that a lot of skeptics will bring out. I'm trying to remember one now. There's this weird nerve thing in our necks. It's in every mammal, and it really doesn't cause any nerve or blood vessel thing that really doesn't matter for most of us, except for giraffes. And it really causes them trouble, at some point for some reason. But what about that? What about things like that? What about, of course, they have an assumption here. They have an assumption. The people who are the skeptics who come up with that, they have an assumption. If something is designed, they believe it needs to have a purpose. I can buy that it has a purpose. How about nipples on a man? What purpose does it serve? What about tissues that are susceptible to cancers? What purpose does that serve? Perhaps we're inventing purpose that may or may not exist. Whenever we come up with explanations for these things. They assume that a, quote, flawed creation implies a flawed creator. Is that true? Does a flawed creation imply a flawed creator? What we find, do I have that up here? No, I don't. We find that the Genesis 1:31, what does that say? That God looked at all his creation and it was very good. Very good, he says there. So was it a flawless creation by saying it is very good?
Not when he created it. The mankind is certainly messed it up.
When he created it, it was a paradise, wasn't it? I don't know if we can define it as flawed or perfect, depending on our conception of things, but it was a paradise. It's what God wanted for us. It was the curse of sin that made this world flawed. We see in Genesis 3, chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. Actually, I do have that on the next page, I think. Before we move on, I'll look at those things in a second, the objections that people have for the teleological argument. There's also the moral argument. What's the moral argument? Any idea?
I think it has to do with the fact that why would we want to be more moral about things if there's no God?
Yeah.
No creator.
We have a sense of right and wrong, don't we? A built-in sense of right and wrong. It doesn't always line up with what God thinks is right and wrong, but, I mean, how many people out there in the world who live in a devil's life and they think, no, I'm a pretty good person? Well, how do you determine whether they're a good person or not? Well, of course, we have the scriptures that help us determine that. But they have how they feel. Oh, I haven't done anything too bad. So they have this idea. What does Romans 2, 14 and 15 say?
Well, when the Gentiles, which are not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts and conscience, also bearing witness in their thoughts. The meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another.
Okay. So they've created a law to themselves that actually lines up with God's law, at least on some things, right? We find that throughout cultures all over the world, murder is wrong. I mean, there might be a few exceptions here or there, but for the most part, murder is wrong, or considered wrong in so many cultures, with or without the Bible. Adultery, again, in most cultures, is considered to be wrong. And it is wrong. So there's all sorts of things that people do come up with. Theft, another thing that people will think, hey, is wrong. And that's right. So some of these things that God instilled in people, or that we have come up with on our own, it happened to fit with the idea of God.
On the other hand, when people come up with ideas like abortion is fine and things like that, God turns them over to their base mind.
Yeah.
And lets them go on their way. You know, if they don't want to follow him, he lets them fall into the ditch.
That's right. Romans 1, he lets them fall into a debased mind, those who do not want to follow along with what God says on those things. Psalm 32 and verse 9. This is one of the things that separates us from the animals. And this is what Psalm 32 mentions. Somebody read that, please.
Be ye not as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle, lest they come near unto thee.
Alright, so this is in the context of forgiveness, right? This is a psalm of forgiveness. David is saying, come to the Lord, be forgiven. Don't be like an animal that has to be forced to do these kinds of things, because they'd have no understanding, right? Animals don't have understanding of that sort of thing, but we do, right? Because we're human beings created in God's image. Some objections, counter-arguments against God, is the argument from suffering, which kind of goes into the teleological argument and some of the things I was going to mention. I think I do have that on this slide. All right, a perfect world was created. All right, we see in Genesis 1:31, a perfect world was created. At the very least, perfect for us, right? And then we find that sin entered the world by free will. It was the free will choice of Adam and Eve to disobey God. To disobey God in order to do what they wanted to do over what God told them to do, right? Do we have free will today? Mm-hmm. Yes, of course we do. We have free will. We can choose to follow the Lord and do what he says, or choose not to. That's our choice. That's up to us. And so everyone has free will or at the very least, what does Sam like to call it? The free won't. The idea where we might not be able to control an idea in our head, but we can control whether or not we act upon it. Free won't. We also have, in your insurance policies, whenever it talks about an act of God, what is that?
It's an exclusion.
Acts of God. It's talking about natural disasters, right? So an act of God. I have up there some verses in relation to the flood. Bad things happened to us. In I think 2005, right? There was this huge tsunami. That it was an earthquake, and there was this huge tsunami in the Indian Ocean, and it swept over India, and it was so devastating to the people of that country, and in the surrounding areas. What did they do? Well, surely there were Christians among the hurt and wounded. Did they deserve that? There were innocents. Did they deserve that? Well, I like the silence. No, they didn't deserve it. But we do find that we have these acts of God. That free will, of course, has caused us to... makes it so that we have the free will to sin and perhaps even hurt other people. And so that's where the suffering from other people comes from. What about things that aren't caused by other people, like these, quote, acts of God? Well, they're cause and effect, caused by God as well, or caused by people as well, rather, caused by sin, because of the events of the flood, right? God created a perfect world. Such, quote, acts of God, such destruction that existed or did not exist before the flood. And then we find that the flood happened and broke the world because of our violence, right? Because of the sin that humanity caused. So there was a huge upheaval afterwards in terms of the weather. So as a result, we are now subject to that. Hurricanes and the earthquakes and things of that nature are all results of the flood. which was a result of our sin. Flaws in design. I kind of mentioned that. We'll talk about that as well. Apparent flaws in the creation are designed to remind us that this world is not all there is. Right? Talking about tissues that are susceptible to cancers. Right? It is to remind us that this is not all there is. To cause us to seek a better world to come. To help us improve our lives here. We have all those verses focus on things above, Colossians 3, 1 and 2, not on things below. James 1, 2, and 2 through 4, I count it all joy when you suffer tribulation. Romans 5, 3 and 4, tribulation brings perseverance, brings character, brings hope. 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10, Paul talks about his thorn in the flesh. All these considerations from suffering actually build us up and help us. They do. They help us. It may not seem like it, especially I know some suffer quite a lot. But in the long run, it helps us with regard to our eternity. This world is not all there is. There is more. And I thank God for that. And He reminds us every time we stub a toe, every time we have an accident. Every time we are diagnosed with something that we can't shake, reminds us that there is more. All right. Oh, I don't have time to talk about that. The next one, genetics of Adam and Eve, there's an argument that I've come across that it just really sticks in my mind, that just seems like it fits everything perfectly and it's mind-blowing, and I encourage you to come next week so we can talk about that. But any thoughts before we close out? I know it's kind of ending on a dour note, talking about suffering. We don't like it. We want to avoid it as much as possible. And I certainly understand that. But it's also helpful, mosquitoes even, are helpful to remind us that there is something greater out there that is waiting for us.
I'd much rather suffer with the knowledge of what does lie in wait for me than suffer without that knowledge. And the people who argue against God because of suffering, obviously they just don't get it.
Yeah.
Hopefully they will someday.
Yeah.
Before it's too late.
Yeah. I would rather be in this position right now where we may suffer, we will suffer, and yet we have a hope after this. And I'm grateful for that hope, knowing that it's waiting for those who are faithful.
What I was going to say was, you know, as we get older, you know, and we don't know what, you know, medically or whatever is going to take us from this life, you know, and you do kind of live in fear of, you know, what might be wrong with you, because it could lead, you know, to your death. And, you know, it's like Dan said, you know, Christians have that peace to know, you know, what is at the end of that journey. And, you know, everyone doesn't have that. And so that gives us some consolation to deal with, you know, whatever is going on with us or whatever could go on with us in the future.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, it should be in the minds of not just older people. I'm just saying that as you get older, you know, that that happens. But, you know, even with young people, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know what could take you out of this life. And that should also be in the back of their minds as well. You know, that if something happens, that you do have that peace if you're a Christian.
Right. Sin, disease, even the weather, at least bad weather, is all a result of sin. It's all a result of our rebellion against God. And so while we live in a world that's dealing with all of that, with our shortcomings, we are in a world that God created, and it's still there is still beauty here, and we can still recognize the truth and the beauty that God exists and that He is here for us, and that He will prepare us, or He can prepare us, He will prepare us if we let Him for that which is to come.